This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As the weather patterns shift, firefighters in Southern California have finally gained the upper hand. Recovery will be neither quick nor easy, but the crisis appears to have passed. There is still no relief in sight for the parched, suffering Southeast. Some call the drought there, which began more than a year ago, a slow-motion disaster. Reservoirs are levels are down drastically. In Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama, Georgia, and the Carolinas, there is what scientists call exceptional drought, the likes of which come about, on average, once every 50 years. In Atlanta, watering restrictions have been in place for months now. The Georgia Aquarium in Atlanta emptied some of its displays. Toilets in the Atlanta airport are set to flush faster to save water, and Georgia's governor canceled the state-sponsored fishing tournament. Lawns are brown, plants are dead, and it's illegal for Georgians to water either. Later in the hour, on the opinion page, Turkey's standoff with the Kurds and an argument that we might see another Iraqi quagmire. But first, the Southeast drought. If you live in the Southeast, what restrictions do you face? What, if anything, can be done? Call us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. We start today in Gwinnett County, Georgia, where drought conditions are so bad that officials are enlisting the public to call in and rat out their neighbors.
They're watering their lawn at 8:30 this morning. Plus, one of the sprinklers is watering the road.
I have felt the lawn. It's wet. The sidewalk is wet. So they're obviously watering pretty regularly. Just wanted you to know.
That tape courtesy of WSB-TV in Atlanta, Georgia. Frank Stevens is the guy who listens to those calls. He's the program specialist for the Gwinnett County Department of Water Resources, and he joins us by phone from his office. Nice to have you on the program today.
Hello, thank you.
And you're getting a lot of calls like those we just heard?
Those and some even more interesting calls regarding the outdoor water use ban.
What are the more interesting ones like?
One that I overheard today, lady called in. She really wanted to give her dog a bath outdoors because of an apparent flea problem. But mm-hmm. her advice was to take the dog indoors since there's an outdoor water ban.
And so some neighbor might see this as a backhanded attempt to water her lawn.
We've had curious reports on a variety of infractions, not just the recordings that you had there mm-hmm. earlier. For example, one lady, she was rather bitter. She had dropped her groceries in the driveway and was hosing down the remains, and one of the neighbors reported her for washing her driveway illegally.
Mm-hmm. What is the penalty she might face for that illegal watering?
Well, we have an escalated schedule of enforcement. We will first send out a warning letter, construed to be a strong educational letter, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
We've sent some 1,400 of those since the end of September. Some people we've given a second warning letter to. Others, some 30 accounts, we've actually locked off the meter. But if it's a chronic problem, we issue citations, and we've issued a half dozen of those where a person would have to appear in court and could face a fine of up to $1,000.
But in some 30 cases, you said, you've actually cut off the water.
Correct.
And that's a pretty stiff penalty by itself.
Yes, it is. And we can do that administratively without consulting the judge.
Uh-huh. Now, I assume there have also been, regrettably, human nature being what it is, cases of neighbors just trying to get their neighbors in trouble?
A few, yes, there have.
Yeah. That's always a problem, isn't it? Do you have squads are you patrolling the neighborhoods to enforce these regulations too?
We have about 20 people that are involved in enforcing the outdoor water use ban. Most of our trips out into neighborhoods are at the response of a phone call. However, all of our crews that might be doing work in residential or commercial areas are authorized if they see some watering going on that is out of season, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
They're authorized to make a stop and also bring the address back to us so that we can send one of those educational warning letters.
And is all of this having an effect?
Yes, actually, our water usage has dropped back significantly from what it was before the total outdoor ban by about 20%.
That's important.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, is there much more you have left in your quiver of restrictions you can put in?
Well, we're looking at stepping up our overall water conservation program and some of our outreach, some of our, for example, rebates for plumbing fixtures, exchanging plumbing fixtures.
So you get to the low-flow toilets, that sort of thing.
Right, right. But as far as enforcement goes, I couldn't imagine. I failed to mention not only if you go to court could you get a fine of up to $1,000, but even a 60-day jail term.
Hmm. And that's pretty severe for watering your lawn.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, but still there's some people who just can't stand a brown lawn.
Well, so for some, I reckon it's a large investment.
Hmm. If this drought goes on much longer, what are you going to be able to do?
In terms of enforcement?
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine much worse than a $1,000 fine and a jail penalty, but we're going to have to cogitate that, I believe.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Frank Stevens is the program specialist for the Gwinnett County Department of Water Resources. He joined us by phone from his office there. And Susanna Capaluto is the radio news director for Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta, where she's been covering the drought, and she joins us now from a studio there. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be here.
And we mentioned this drought going on for better than a year now?
It's about a year. I think we had it going on, I think, 18 months, somewhere around there, but it's sort of been under the radar. It really didn't hit us all, I think, until the beginning of October when we got the all-outdoor water restriction.
All-outdoor water restriction. So, in other words, almost 10 months of drought, and then people finally began to take notice.
Well, we had this restriction where you could water every other day, things like that, so it wasn't that severe, but you know, once we saw our reservoirs really go down and the shorelines were starting to show, I think people really got worried.
Yeah, I was in northeastern Georgia in September, and then you could see, I mean, there was a little sand where people like to, you know, take their buckets down and play with their children, but then a whole lot of red clay before you saw water.
Absolutely. And that's how all of our reservoirs are starting to look now. They're running dry.
Mm-hmm. How worried are people beginning to get?
Well, I think they sort of, no one really knows how much water we still have. There are estimates from, you know, 90 days you hear, but then you hear people say, no, we have 9 months if we just dig deeper into the reservoirs. 90 days is sort of the time when we get to the usable water, so to speak, the one that you can easily pump out of a reservoir. Mm-hmm. After that, you have to go to the murky levels, and that just, you know, will be more expensive to treat, but you know, there is water. We just don't know really how much.
Let's see if we get a caller in on the line. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255. What restrictions exist where you live, and would you call in to rat out your neighbor if he or she was sprinkling? 800-989-8255. Greg is calling us from Fort Wayne in Indiana.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I'm curious, does this affect businesses? Specifically golf courses.
Is watering been cut off for golf courses, Susanna Capaluto?
It has. I mean, the watering ban is they can water their greens, okay, but not really the grass. And there are some, you know, golf courses now that want to use the pond water to water the lawn.
The ponds that they may have on the golf course.
Exactly, exactly. And we do have a couple of big, you know, PGA golf tournaments here in this region that have a huge economic impact. And there's a fear that, you know, this could impact them if there's no, you know, green lawn for the but the Masters is not affected, by the way. Augusta is not part of this heavy drought. They have enough water.
Okay, well, that's next spring in any case, so by which time
right.
we all hopefully hope it will have rained a little bit.
Right, exactly.
Thanks very much for the call. And I assume there are other businesses, car washes, for example, that have been affected?
Absolutely. And I heard today that when you rent a car in Atlanta, it will likely be dirty. Rental cars are no longer washing the outsides of their cars, just the inside.
Here's an email. This is ridiculous. We should not be having this discussion in 2007 in the U.S. of America. We have dancing fountains in the deserts of Las Vegas, thousands of pools in California, now brown lawns in Georgia. When will people wake up and realize we are the responsible parties and we need to change, adapt to the conditions that Mother Nature presents to us? I have no sympathy for the people of overdeveloped regions of the South, especially Florida, that don't have water or water is becoming a much more critical natural resource. That from Jeff in Cleveland, a great lake state, and he says he hopes it's stays that way. Inevitably, just as the fires in Southern California raise questions about where people are building houses, a drought in the Southeast, that brings up a lot of questions about where people are developing, well, not just houses, but businesses in southeastern United States.
Well, that's the problem with this river system, the Chattahoochee River, which feeds Atlanta and goes all the way down to Florida. There's a lot of people that depend on this little river. It's really not that big. And people have always said that, you know, we haven't planned very well for growth. And we have a lot of, you know, this developers come in, they build the houses, and they don't wait for the plumbing to come. They just put everybody on septic.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, a quarter of all homes in Metro Atlanta are on septic tanks. So here is that water, but it takes months to seep through. And in a drought, that doesn't help you replenish the river. So, you know, it's poor planning, a lot of people say. Plus, we don't have really reservoirs built to hold water for all the people.
Is anybody talking seriously about slowing down growth, at least until such time as some of this water planning can be rectified?
Well, the state is starting to, at least Georgia, from Georgia's perspective, we're starting, of course, a statewide water plan. But there's also this water sharing agreement that the Alabama, Florida, and Georgia have to. They've been working on it for 17 years. They still don't know how they're going to share this water. There's a lot of planning in the works. Some people say we need to build reservoirs. I mean, it is definitely going to be a hot-button issue during our legislative session, which starts in January.
In January, so they're going to get right on it.
Oh, right on. Well, that's, you know, right.
Yeah, and maybe it'll rain.
Well, that's what we hope for. But there's actually some communities are putting moratoriums now on new construction because they just can't, you know, building permits, because they have to cut down 10% of water. The governor ordered a 10% cut in all water use starting in November for 61 counties. And in order to reach that, they all have to sort of do auto-watering like Gwinnett County is doing. They're already at 20%, so they're fine. But others have put moratorium on, new construction.
Stay with us, Susanna Capilouto. She's with Georgia Public Radio, with us from Atlanta, which is the epicenter of a drought that's afflicting the southeastern United States. A lot of people are going to considerable lengths to save some water. In a moment, we'll talk about exactly when a drought becomes a drought, and we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation. Stay with us. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the drought in the southeastern U.S. and how people deal with these slow-motion disasters. If you live in the southeast, what restrictions do you face? What, if anything, do you think can be done? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org, and you can tell us your stories on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Susanna Capilouto is our guest. She's the radio news director for Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Kate. Kate's with us from Carrollton, is that right, in Georgia?
Carrollton.
Carrollton. They just left off the N. I apologize for that.
Which is west of Atlanta. And we have been under severe water restrictions longer than the city of Atlanta has. And my comment about it is, you know, and I have small children, and in April, I bought a yard sprinkler for them for the summer, and we were never able to use it, which is fine. But it would seem much more fair to me if the burden to conserve water was shared equitably. And in our town, people were allowed to fill their pools all summer,
mm-hmm.
if it was an in-ground pool. And also, there is a booming business in well digging. People who are on city water and sewer are digging wells and put up a little sign in their yard that says, "This landscape watered by well water," and that's exempt from the restrictions. And I just don't feel like that seems like the burden is shared by everyone.
Yeah, I'm sure that she's not the only person to come up with those kinds of complaints, Susanna Capilouto.
No, we actually have well diggers are really having booming business. We couldn't get, you know, when the story first broke that well diggers, you know, are busy, we couldn't get one on the phone because they were so busy digging wells just to do a news story on it. But that they're really the ones that are busy. If you got water somewhere on your property, you know, people start digging.
Mm-hmm. If groundwater levels are part of the problem, wells are not going to help that, are they?
Well, not really. They won't help really the watershed, but it's the problem. I think they're not exempt yet. I mean, that could be the next step. It really could be. The thing about pools, I think people just figured you fill your pool and the water is just there. You can't keep refilling it.
Right.
You know, when you sprinkle, it kind of gets lost.
Thanks very much for the call, Kate. Any truth to reports that people are hoarding water?
Well, there was a report today in the Atlanta paper about, you know, some people who just sort of try to, you know, put water in the basement and stuff like that. And, I mean, I think it is on everyone's mind when you're standing there and you buy your bottled water. Everybody thinks about water. Maybe people just pick up a few, you know, extra gallons. But I have not seen huge hoarding efforts. I'm sure there's, you know, amongst the 5 million people in Metro Atlanta, there are always a few that think they have to sort of think ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a little too early to think that far ahead.
And let me ask you a little bit about the politics of this, not just Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue questions about how well he has handled this, but also intrastate relations and a very public dispute with the governor of Alabama.
Absolutely. That is the big key, because the problem here is really how much water is the reservoir Lake Lanier letting go. Lake Lanier feeds Metro Atlanta with water, and because of the Endangered Species Act, it has to have a minimal flow into the Chattahoochee River. So that water just flies right by Atlanta and doesn't even, you know, we can't use it and then it goes back. It goes straight to Alabama. Alabama says, well, that's our water. We are entitled to it, and they need it for power plants. They have a nuclear power plant on the Chattahoochee River. And then, of course, Florida. That water runs all the way in the Apalachicola Bay, and you have some very endangered mussel species down there and a very fragile ecosystem that relies on the Chattahoochee River. And because of the Endangered Species Act, people in Georgia have to give up water, and that's where the fight is about.
And that sounds like that one's going to end up in court.
It has been, yes. It's already in court, and this is part of our, that's why the three governors of Florida, Georgia, and Alabama are meeting with the president, I think, on Thursday to hopefully come up with, you know, something that will alleviate this drought problem or the water problem in this area.
In the meantime, I hope it rains.
We all hope that, yes. We have beautiful weather today, not a cloud in the sky.
Yeah, that's taking on a bad taste in your mouth after a while.
Yes.
Susanna Capelluto, thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Susanna Capelluto, news director at Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, who joined us from their studios there. Brian Fuchs is a climatologist at the National Drought Mitigation Center in Lincoln, Nebraska. He also prepares the weekly United States Drought Monitor and joins us today from Nebraska Public Radio in Lincoln. And it's good to have you with us.
Hello. How are you this afternoon?
I'm well. And I gather that the United States Drought Monitor has more readers than usual, probably the last few weeks.
Yes, the interest in the U.S. Drought Monitor has definitely increased this year, especially with the severity of the drought in the southeast, as well as situations out in the western part of the country, where we're also seeing some extreme situations in the western parts of California and into Arizona, all the way up into Idaho.
Mm-hmm. And drought, how do we define it? Do we know it when we see it? And is it easy for government officials to sort of look the other way for a good long while?
You know, drought can have various definitions based on the clientele who's trying to find that definition. The easiest one is a lack of water over a definitive time period. It can be a short-term drought or a long-term drought, or it can be a mix of both. And as far as how easily it can be ignored, it easily can be ignored. One of the missions of the National Drought Mitigation Center is to put drought in the forefront of people's minds, especially policymakers, because they're the ones who can really help in establishing drought plans for a particular state or municipal government. And at that point, we hope that with these plans in place, they are better prepared and have done their homework, so to speak, for planning purposes. So when a drought does take place, using these mitigating circumstances, they can help lessen the impacts related to the drought.
Mm-hmm. And finally, well, let's get some listeners in on the conversation. And again, 800-989-8255. And let's go now to Brian. Brian's with us from Virginia Beach in Virginia.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was in Santa Barbara in the 80s, I think it was, when we had like a seven-year drought. And the one, because Santa Barbara at that time just had local water, you know, the reservoir just over the mountains, and the lack of water was really the only effective way to keep growth down.
Hmm.
Because the county supervisor could say, we don't have the water, so you can't build this house or you can't develop this farm because we don't have the water. And, you know, because everybody's got property rights and stuff, and so a lot of other things happen. I think people were cooperative and taking showers in a bucket and all that kind of stuff. And Of course, they built the desal plant, but it took them so long to build it, by the time they built it, the drought was over.
Now, desal, of course, desalinization, taking
right.
seawater and getting the salt out of it, which is which ain't cheap.
Right, right. Well, it was, they didn't have any water, so they spent the money, but I think they sell the water now to other people. But it was just the only way to control growth because, you know, people want to build there, but now they have other water, so they have other issues about growth. So.
Yeah, well, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Sure.
And it can, I guess, be a break on eventually on growth, as we were hearing from Susanna Capelluto. Brian Fuchs?
Yes. We still hear reports out of California that when new growth is taking place, that you have to take a serviceable meter out of production to get a new one into production. So in some instances, people are buying an old property for the water meter before they can develop it. And California is especially unique in the way they manage their water with a multitude of reservoirs throughout the state and how they ship water from north to south and east to west across the state. It's very unique in our country as far as the magnitude that they do manage their water, and they need to because of their population and their growth.
Mm. Let's talk now with Pam. Pam's with us from Union City in Ohio.
Hello.
Hi.
When we had a really bad, I guess, dry spell in August, it's Ohio, it's August, you know, dry spell.
Right.
We used gray water. We, you know, got the old-fashioned rain barrel and watered our garden that way. And we hooked up a long tube from our washer drain pipe out to some other tanks, then ran hoses from there and watered our garden that way so that we could, you know, save our garden from the dryness. Is that kind of stuff going on out in the southeast? Or
Brian Fuchs, a gray water, which is, of course, untreated, not good for drinking necessarily, but water your lawn should be fine.
Yes, with the use of gray water, there has been a movement and to use more of these techniques to bring this usable water out for a secondary use after the primary use has taken place. The problem with that is sometimes it's harder for people to do this than what they actually can put the effort forth into trying to accomplish this. I think it is a good method of water conservation, and it is a technique that should be investigated for not only the Southeast, but for across the country, anywhere there is a water issue. It is a good way of alleviating some of the stress on public water systems.
Okay. Pam, thanks for the advice.
Oh, you're welcome. Have a great day.
Bye-bye. You too. Here's an email we got from Alice, formerly of Seattle, Washington. Despite its notorious rainfall, the Puget Sound region, i.e. Seattle, gets much of its public water from snowmelt, so we got winter notice about pending drought when the snowpack was low. In the late 1980s, the city of Seattle began to promote implementation of drought response, including lawn watering restrictions. Overnight, my tidy little street, which practiced the green lawn imperative, adopted these watering restrictions, and brown laws became the lawns became the fashion. Eventually, I replaced my lawn with a perennial garden, which needs limited watering during the traditional summer drought. Yes, Seattle has water police, but it works, and we are no worse for this tiny deprivation. I guess it's just asking people to change a little bit about the way they live their lives or the way they see their properties, because landscaping is a big part of a lot of people's properties.
Landscaping is very important to many homeowners, and people want to take care of it, and it does add property value. There are techniques to implement that would decrease outdoor water usage based on the type of foliage and plants that you do have around your property. There are drought-tolerant varieties of grasses that can be grown, as well as other plants and shrubbery that use less water than other varieties. And so that's one of the personal things that a person can do to prepare in a drought situation to help alleviate the impacts is by doing a personal inventory of their water use and looking at their outdoor watering techniques and the type of plants they're maintaining. And if they can make some changes there, it may cost some money in the beginning, but in the long run, they're going to save money by not having to pay to water those plants.
Hmm. Here's an email we got from Chris. I'm a water industry professional supplying meters and meter reading equipment to water utilities. It's well known in the industry but not widely publicized that it's common for water utilities to report that as much as one-third of the water delivered from the plant is lost before it gets to the end user or is unregistered by the water meter due to meter slippage. Both of these problems are easily mitigated by the use of available technologies. Do you know if he's right?
You know, we have heard about issues like this, especially in larger metropolitan cities and also with cities that have aging infrastructure, that there is the certain amount of water that is lost just in the delivery process. And so I think as a municipal water manager, that is one thing to investigate, and it may be worth the monetary investment to go ahead and try and fix this infrastructure, which is going to be costly. But in the long run, it's going to, A, save water, and B, you're going to have a better water accessibility during a drought situation.
We're talking with Brian Fuchs of the National Drought Mitigation Center about the situation, especially in the southeastern part of the country. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Dan. Don from Salt Lake City.
Yes, thank you. This is Don Duff. I'm a retired government fishery scientist. One of the things we forget about most often is the groundwater pumping and the loss of groundwater from our aquifers. And that, coupled with the drought, could have a significant effect on a lot of areas. And it is happening from Maine to Georgia to Florida, the West. We're losing our underground aquifers to ground pumping more wells. And so we need to be cognizant of that and limit growth in a lot of places. Las Vegas, for example, has a proposal to massive groundwater pump eastern Nevada, and it could affect western Utah. And you know, that like they need to limit growth in that area. And
I take it you're not running for public office in either of those places.
No, but I'm trying to bring to the public some information that could help in candidates, you know, that we need to take a responsible look at our water situation. Drought is one thing, but the the use of massive groundwater pumping in more wells, we have to take that into account also when we're developing things and people's livelihood. We don't want to take from one rural area to support an urban area. And I believe it was Susan Capilotti, your Georgia
Capiluto. I mispronounced it a couple of times, too, but it's Capiluto.
Capiluto. She mentioned the Endangered Species Act, and we have several native trout populations in the West here that if groundwater pumping in the drought it goes on, you know, we could lose headwater streams on national forests and other areas, which could reduce populations and therefore put them into a listing for the Endangered Species Act. And we want to try to keep away from that, but that's one thing that could come down the road.
Put this in terms of a question to Brian Fuchs, and this is an email that we got from Jennifer. I'm interested in how groundwater fits into the issue. An earlier caller said private wells are not limited to water rationing, and those who can afford it are drilling more wells. Shouldn't surface water and groundwater be managed in an integrated way to avoid depletion of either source of water? Brian?
She's exactly correct. When you start looking about water availability, and we have to remember that water is a finite resource. It is not unlimited. And so we have to do an inventory of what we have and understand the best way to utilize that resource. And this does include taking into account groundwater as well as surface water flows. They are connected. If you start pumping water out of the ground level or groundwater, and as the other caller mentioned, the aquifers start dropping, that in turn is going to influence your surface water flows because they play off of each other, and it takes a very long time for those systems to recharge. And if you're going to manage one and not the other, you're going to end up with definite problems. And you're running into these cases in many parts of the West where there's water rights being argued amongst surface water right holders and people pumping groundwater. So this is an issue that is not unique. It's been coming to the forefront more and more across the country, especially in heavily populated areas and areas where groundwater and surface water is still being utilized. Mm-hmm. But to do a full inventory of your water, you need to consider both, and you have to manage both equally.
Yeah. And finally, we just have a few seconds left. What does the forecast look like? Are they going to get any rain?
You know, right now we are in a La Nina situation, which for the southeast does not bode well. Usually in a La Nina winter, the area along the Gulf Coast experiences below normal precipitation, and the area in the Ohio River Valley towards the Mississippi River Valley typically receives above normal precipitation. So the southern tier of the Gulf Coast states, southern Alabama, southern Georgia, into South Carolina and Florida, we really are not anticipating much recovery in the drought situation at this time through the winter months.
Well, let's hope you're wrong about that. We fear you're not, but let's hope you are. Brian Fuchs, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Brian Fuchs, a climatologist at the National Drought Mitigation Center in Lincoln, Nebraska, with us from Nebraska Public Radio in Lincoln. Coming up, Turkey, terrorism, and Iraq are on the opinion page, why the U.S. faces a crisis along Iraq's northern border. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.